From Illinois to New Mexico, Kentucky to California, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the American Legislative Exchange Council has published its 2018 Rich States, Poor States report that analyzes each state's economic competitiveness. Jonathan Williams of ALEC joins us with details. The latest special election for a seat in Congress was held last week. Andy Roth of the Club for Growth has the real story on what happened in Arizona. Nebraska has passed a milestone occupational licensing reform. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine gets details from Jim Vogel of the Platt Institute. And the hypocrisy of the left is on full display when you compare reaction to the Monica Lewinsky and Stormy Daniels scandals. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Center for Vision and Values at Grove City College has an American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Each year, the American Legislative Exchange Council publishes a report on the progress or lack of progress the 50 states are making when it comes to improving their economic competitiveness. Jonathan Williams is chief economist and vice president of ALEC. He is also co-author of the Rich States, Poor States report. He joins us now to discuss the report's findings. Jonathan, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Jonathan, first of all, how many years have you been producing the Rich States, Poor States report? And give us just an overview as to what the report is.
It's amazing to think that we've been producing this report for now 11 years in conjunction with Arthur Laffer and Stephen Moore. And for a while there, we thought we'd have to start renaming it Poor States, Poorer States during the economic downturn when all the states were in huge budget problems with red ink and raising taxes. Now, of course, we've turned the corner again, so we've seen a lot change over these 11 years. But what we do in the report is basically measure state economic health and economic competitiveness and ranking the states in tax, regulatory, and labor policy. We've kept our 15 variables consistent, which is fantastic over these 11 years. So you're able to go back through all 11 years and have a consistent time series to analyze either the progress or lack of progress in some cases of where states have gone over this time frame, all at richstatespoorstates.org. We have all 11 years of data. So it's really interesting to see, and we've seen some pretty interesting things over these 11 years of changes.
So if you love economic data, this is a treasure trove, and you can spend your whole weekend looking at it if you like. We're not going to spend quite that much time on it today, but before we get to the horse race, who's ahead and who isn't, tell us a little bit about those 15 variables. I would assume that taxes and regulations are among them, but tell us what we're measuring here.
So what we measure and then why we measure it are both important. And what we measure are 15 equally weighted factors of everything from tax rates on individual income and business income and sales tax burden, property tax burden, basically all the various types of taxes that a state can levy. And we look at it at both the state and local level, which is awfully important. Since those local taxes in states like Pennsylvania, for instance, Philly, states like Ohio with a lot of local levies really do add significantly to the tax burden. We look at regulation and things like labor policy, like right to work and minimum wage and some of those factors that really do impact competitiveness on a labor and regulatory side. And we chose these factors because, A, we know they matter for economic growth, and Art Laffer has had these really in his back pocket for several decades now, things that matter. But B, and perhaps even as importantly, is they're things that legislators absolutely can control and influence and change in their state capitals. And there's lots of rankings out there, but I think ours are so important because they're factors that can be changed. They're levers of policy that can be influenced and made different.
When you talk about labor policy, and that's something we discuss quite often here on this program, right-to-work states, we've seen some states, Jonathan, such as Wisconsin, Michigan, that have had really significant changes in their labor climates. As we look at these rankings, are states like that on the upswing?
Well, absolutely. As a Michigan native myself, the Michigan comeback story to me is an inspiring story of a state that has turned it around from really our single state recession days, where we were just down and out as a state economy, to a state now that is really up there in terms of economic growth in the Midwest and helping to lead the way to the economic recovery for the region because of right to work, because of tax reform, and many other things that Michigan lawmakers have done. And that's really a hopeful note for other states to say, if Michigan can turn it around, you can turn it around. And Wisconsin's a similar story under Scott Walker and their reforms. Indiana led the way in the Midwest even before Michigan and Wisconsin started turning it around. So there's lots of stories of inspiration of policy changes that actually have made a difference for hardworking taxpayers across those states.
Let's talk for a couple of minutes here, Jonathan, about taxation, because that's always something that folks look at. We all end up paying taxes, some of us more so than others because of where we live. As a general trend, the states together, are we seeing tax policy moving in the right direction? Are we starting to see states dial back on tax burden, or are we continuing down that path, as you put it earlier, to making everybody a little bit more poor as a result of it?
Well, I think what we see now, Loman, is a balkanization effect of states, where we have the rich states, poor states dichotomy, where we have many states looking to do the right thing and pursue pro-taxpayer, pro-free market reforms that will make their states more competitive. And that would be roughly the top half or two-thirds of our index. And then we do have the states that are really cemented in their ideology on tax and spend. And they're moving in the wrong direction continually. We're hearing things like New Jersey looking to take up a millionaire's tax again, or Massachusetts, or Maine even, and New York, of course, and California, those examples. Illinois, we've all seen those examples. So I think that there is a big gap between the states that are taking it seriously on the competitiveness race and states that just think that their tax and spend ways will continue to show different results, even though they're trying the same approach over year after year. But I think overall, federal tax reform is now enabled states to do more things aggressively when it comes to cut taxes. I think that's the untold story, really, of President Trump's tax reform, first in 31 years, is states are now seeing the benefits of it from economic growth and unexpected revenue because of how state tax code are linked to the federal tax code. And that, I think, is going to be the big story of the 2018 legislative sessions, more states cutting taxes as a result of federal tax reform.
Now let's get to the horse race. Which states made your top 10? What's the most competitive state? Which one is doing the best among the 50?
Well, I wish I could say there was a surprise, but now for 11 years running, we have had Utah at number one in our rich states, poor states economic outlook ranking, and that has been an incredible success story of a state that has had a prudent approach to budgeting, kept tax burdens relatively low, regulations in check, and also has done something that is way ahead of the curve for most states, and that is capped the massive unfunded pension obligations in public sector plans that are threatening the future financial sustainability of many states and cities across the country. They're followed by Idaho at number two, which was our big winner this year, moving from number 10 last year to number two. They took advantage of federal tax reform and had some of the biggest tax cuts in the last couple of decades. They're followed by Indiana, North Dakota, Arizona, Florida, North Carolina, Wyoming, South Dakota, and Virginia in the top 10.
And let's take a look at the bottom 10. Let me just hazard a guess. I would say California, New York, New Jersey, somewhere in that mix.
Bingo. Bingo. You've got it, my friend. New York is 50th out of 50. Once again, they've been either 49th or 50th, all 11 editions of rich states, poor states. Vermont is 49th. Bernie Sanders would be proud of that anti-free market environment. Illinois, California, New Jersey, Hawaii, Minnesota, Montana, Maine, and Oregon round out the bottom 10. And of course, that has a pretty consistent theme of tax and spend in states that are not looking to make themselves more competitive for new business development.
And again, we have been talking with Jonathan Williams, and he is chief economist and vice president at the American Legislative Exchange Council. We've been discussing their Rich States, Poor States report, 2018 edition. Jonathan, tell us just a little bit about ALEC and where folks can go if they'd like to read Rich States, Poor States.
Well, first of all, your listeners can all go to richstatespoorstates.org for 11 years now of data. You have complete access to it, and you can see how Pennsylvania and other states across the country have changed policies. And we also empower you to adjust policies to see how it would change your state ranking, which is a very cool new feature that we have. And ALEC has been around. It's a really unique organization, been around nearly 45 years to support three principles: free markets, limited government, and federalism. I've been with us for more than a decade now, traveled to 50 states, and we work with state legislators, about 2,000 of those across the 50 states. Seth Grove from Pennsylvania, for instance, is our House Chair in Pennsylvania. We work with some of the finest men and women and state legislators all across the country.
Jonathan Williams, again, from the American Legislative Exchange Council, is with us every year to talk about the Rich States, Poor States Report. Jonathan, thank you for taking time to be with us.
Always great to join you, my friend.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth has been keeping an eye on special congressional elections around the country that have popped up for various reasons. We had one this past week. We're going to talk about it today. Andy, good to have you here.
Hey, thanks for having me, Loman.
In Arizona, a special election in a seat held by a Republican, a seat that Donald Trump did well in. Tell us why we had that open seat and what was the outcome of last week's special election?
Yeah, the previous occupant of the seat is Trent Franks, who unfortunately had to resign under a cloud of scandal. He promptly left earlier this year, and the governor promptly scheduled a special election with a very short timetable on it. They had the primary almost immediately. Debbie Lesko won that primary, and then she faced a formidable Democrat just this past week. It is a very conservative district. Because Republicans lost in a special election in a very conservative district in Pennsylvania earlier this year, Republicans were worried that they were going to lose this one too. But that never happened. Trump never went to the district. They didn't really nationalize the race. Republicans did have to spend a lot, and they did win by only single digits when they should have won by double digits. But Republicans held the seat, and it's time to move on to the next race. There are a lot of lessons, I suppose, that we can learn from this. But the good news is that Debbie Lesko is a conservative. She will be joining the House Freedom Caucus, and she is a very good addition to the U.S. House.
As we look at these last couple of special elections, Andy, of course, Pennsylvania 18 went to a Democrat. It had been carried by Donald Trump by a large margin, although I always point out it had a 60,000-plus Democrat voter registration edge in that district. Nonetheless, it had been trending Republican. As you pointed out, the Arizona special on Tuesday, the margin was closer than what you might expect. Is this a product of sort of a building blue wave, or is it just a matter of now you don't have an incumbent and voters have to choose a fresh face?
It's a whole host of things, I think. There's a small bit of Democrat waveness to it, I suppose, or maybe even a large one. The polls keep going up and down regarding that. And what I'm talking about is people look at the generic ballot, and the generic ballot is something that is done constantly, and it basically asks, are you more likely or less likely to vote for a Republican or a Democrat in November? And wave elections are usually predicated by a generic ballot that is in the high single digits or low double digits. So, for instance, in 2006, when the Democrats had a huge wave election, the generic ballot ahead of time predicted it because it was very high in their favor. And then in 2010, with the Tea Party surgence, the generic ballot showed that the Republicans were heavily favored. So we kind of can predict these things. Right now, the Democrats are leading in the generic ballot. They have been in the high single digits, but just recently they went down to the mid single digits. So Republicans were thinking, well, wait, maybe we have the ability to keep the House majority. So that's where we are on that. But we still have a few special elections remaining in 2018 ahead of November, and those will provide further data points on to what we can expect.
Where will those special elections be held?
The next one that is most likely going to happen is in Ohio's 12th district. The incumbent, Patrick Teaberry, I think he resigned and he went into the private sector, but I think his resignation was largely because he was frustrated with Congress, frustrated with Trump. Teaberry is cut from the old cloth of liberal republicanism, where he likes to spend money and he likes to pass bipartisan legislation with the Democrats to grow government. And I think he just wasn't able to do that with Trump. So he cut loose and left early. And so they're going to have an election there on May 8th to figure out the nominees. And then they will have a special general election on August 7th to determine the replacement. What's interesting here is that the May 8th special primary is on the same day as the regularly scheduled primary. So the candidates are basically running for two seats, the seat to fill the remainder of this year, and then the seat that would start in January of 2019 to fulfill a two-year term. So we'll see how that goes, but I think Republicans should be able to keep that seat.
As we look back at special elections, there have been, what, seven of them so far since Donald Trump became president. What's the box score? How have Republicans done when it comes to holding on to these seats?
There have been seven, you're right. And we're just talking about House seats here. There have been seven, and Republicans have won six of the seven. Now, that may sound great, like, wow, they're really capturing these wins, when the media is suggesting that the Democrats have a wave. But all seven of these districts are conservative Republican districts held by Republicans. So just for them to capture all seven would be to keep the status quo in line. So the fact that they lost one of them, that one that we mentioned earlier in Pennsylvania 18, shows that they are losing traction. And then Ohio 12 will be the eighth. And then there's also a special election in Texas' 27th district that's scheduled for June 30th. So ultimately, we'll have nine special elections and maybe even more. But these are all Republican districts, all, for the most part, conservative districts. So it's imperative that Republicans keep all of them if they want to keep the majority in November.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. Andy, as always, a bit about the club.
You bet. The Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C., but we have over 250,000 members from all across the country, from all walks of life, from all 50 states in the union, and we're united because we believe in economic freedom. If your listeners are interested, they can go to our website at www.clubforgrowth.org, and if they like what they see, they can join for free.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. Andy, thank you for the update.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
Occupational licensing has a profound effect on many workers. The state of Nebraska recently took a big step toward reform. For details, Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Jim Vogel of the Platt Institute. Eric?
It's really not all that often that we get to talk about good news on the occupational licensing front, so we're going to do that today because usually these are bad stories. These are usually stories about licensing boards abusing their power, telling people they can't work for ridiculous reasons. But today, as I said, we've got some good news out of Nebraska, and that's what we're going to focus on. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Jim Vogel. He is the CEO of the Platt Institute, and he joins us on the phone from Lincoln, Nebraska, right now to talk about these big occupational licensing reforms that passed the legislature and got a signature from the governor this week. Jim, thanks for taking some time and being here.
Glad to be here.
As I said, big news out of Nebraska and potentially a model here for other states to follow as well, Jim. This is a major reform that passed through that that unique unicameral legislature you've got out there, just a Senate, no House, and it got a signature from Governor Pete Ricketts this week. Tell our listeners what the bill does.
Yeah, it has been great news this week. The Occupational Board Reform Act was signed by Governor Ricketts yesterday, and we have been doing individual occupational licensing reform on an individual profession basis for the last couple of years, but this is actually wholesale reform. And what this will require is that Nebraska lawmakers will have to review 20% of each license annually. So a license will get reviewed at least once every 5 years. And they'll look at and consider whether a license is really necessary, whether the training requirements are overly burdensome, whether the certification is abused to exclude competition. At the end of the day, they're looking to see if we are competitive with the other requirements in the country.
So for people who don't pay a lot of attention to occupational licensing, and look, I understand if you don't, it's not necessarily the sexiest of political topics, even though it's pretty important. But if you've not followed this ongoing debate in a lot of states, you might not be familiar with groups like the Pacific Legal Foundation or the Institute for Justice or state-level groups like yours, Jim, that have done a great job of going out and going after these onerous and exclusionary licensing laws, challenging them in court or getting state lawmakers to review and reform them. But that's a slow process. You have to go after each one kind of one by one. It's like playing whack-a-mole, as one of these attorneys at IJ told me one time. This bill in Nebraska, it seems like a big deal to me because it means that the legislature there is going to do this full review over the next 5 years of all the licensing boards, all the licensing laws, every single one of them. That really changes the dynamic here, doesn't it?
Yeah, this is an automatic review process that will be in place by law, requiring the Nebraska legislature to take a look at every license at least once every 5 years, with the intent of identifying less restrictive alternatives that are in place, which may include private certification, registration, inspections, or a combination of these approaches. They'll look at the hours required of schooling within the professions, and they may also even look at whether or not the occupational license itself is needed.
One of the things that comes up a lot in these occupational licensing debates is this idea of protecting public safety, and you see licensing boards that try to justify their existence by arguing, sometimes pretty ridiculously, that licensing of cosmetologists, for example, is necessary to keep workers in salons from stabbing people's eyes out with makeup tools or burning their scalps with hair dryers. I'm not making that up. That's actually things that have been said on the record in committee meetings in Arizona most recently. Is that sort of argument going to fly when you have these legislative-led reviews of these boards? Because it seems like legislators, maybe more so than the boards themselves, are going to be a more neutral party for balancing these interests of public safety against the interests of workers who just want to find jobs.
Absolutely. And what we have found, and I think other states have found it as well, that barriers are put up, built up by the special interests. And what we have found here in Nebraska is the groups that have opposed the effort over the last few years have been those people within the industry. Those people within the industry generally make up the composition of the licensing boards, and they don't want to see the added competition in their industry. The Heritage Foundation actually estimates that it costs an average family in Nebraska about $1,000, the occupational licensing structure that we have here in the state, because we don't have that competition flooding the marketplace.
We're talking with Jim Vogel from the Platt Institute about the big occupational licensing reforms that have passed the legislature and gotten a signature from Governor Pete Ricketts this week there in Nebraska. Jim, just about a minute or so left. I want to talk about the politics of this a little bit because that's really interesting to me. This bill was sponsored by Laura Ebke. She's a state senator. She's the only libertarian member of the Nebraska unicameral. And she says that her position kind of in between, and not a Democrat, not a Republican, let her kind of pitch this idea to both sides. And in the end, it got all but one member of the unicameral voted for this bill. So overwhelming support. What did you see on the ground there in terms of this not bipartisan, but really tripartisan effort?
Yeah, it was actually pretty remarkable. But it also mirrors, I think, the bipartisan support that we see nationwide. If you remember, the Obama administration advocated for changes in occupational licensing on the left and the Heritage Foundation on the right. And so we have seen a trend of nationwide bipartisan support. But in Nebraska, it had multiple sponsors from all parties. Both sides of the aisle understand the barriers that are associated with occupational licensing requirements in the state. It was pretty remarkable to watch this bill go through because we have seen challenges of passing tax reform, criminal justice reform in the state. But this issue, for some reason, resonates on both sides of the aisle, and it's certainly wasn't without challenges to make sure that we had the right bill as it went through the process. But at the end of the day, the vote was 45-1 in favor of this bill.
Yeah, pretty overwhelming support definitely in Nebraska for these reforms, and certainly good reason to think that this is something that could and should be duplicated elsewhere. That is Jim Vogel from the Platt Institute in Nebraska. Thanks for taking some time and joining us, Jim.
Thanks, Eric.
And you can check out more about the Platt Institute online at plattinstitute.org. You can read about the licensing reform bill there, or visit us at reason.com and check out our coverage of occupational licensing in Nebraska and across the rest of the country. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Catch us right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Reaction of the left to the Clinton-era Monica Lewinsky scandal and the recent allegations by Stormy Daniels could not be more different. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Center for Vision and Values at Grove City College examines the hypocrisy on this American Radio Journal commentary.
CBS's 60 Minutes recent exclusive with porn star Stormy Daniels aired almost 20 years to the day of another surreal interview involving a president and sensational sexual allegations. On March 24, 1998, the New York Times provided a platform for one Bernard Lewinsky, father of a lady likewise infamous for lewd antics. And amazingly, Lewinsky exploded not at the man who employed his little girl, Monica, as a sexual plaything in the nation's most revered office, but instead at, well, Ken Starr. "I think this is just the drip torture technique that Ken Starr is using on her," complained the Los Angeles cancer specialist, condemning not Bill Clinton's grotesque techniques on his daughter. "He is just trying to torture her in every possible way." In a bizarre display of misguided venting and parenting, Monica Lewinsky's father directed his fire and fury not at the nation's obscene chief executive in the Oval Office sexually manipulating his child, that is, Bill Clinton, but at Ken Starr. Lewinsky barked at Starr, "Lay off!" These were words that surely would have been better spent hurled at Bill Clinton, eh, Dr. Lewinsky? But no. Dr. Lewinsky surmised that what Ken Starr, not Bill Clinton, had brought upon his daughter was, quote, unconscionable. Displaying his liberal bona fides, Dr. Lewinsky said the nefarious Starr so repulsed him that the counselor made him think of the worst of humans, Joe McCarthy. In fact, said Dr. Lewinsky, this new era was actually worse than that. The Starr era was reminiscent not merely of the McCarthy era, but of the Inquisition and even the Hitler era. Yes, the Hitlerian Ken Starr, said Dr. Lewinsky, was completely out of control. Again, no charges of Bill Clinton being out of control. So that was 20 years ago this time, and it's worth noting today because Dr. Lewinsky's comments weren't solely representative of an arranged father who had gone bananas thanks to Bill Clinton. No, Lewinsky was a proud liberal, and his misdirected indignation was reflective of liberals' misdirected indignation during the Clinton-Lewinsky affair. The liberal press wasn't simply in denial mode. It, too, was in attack mode. Recall how all the president's men joined the pack. The lieutenants in the Clinton camp were on a rampage. Ken Starr was a modern Torquemada. Clinton hatchet man James Carville lampooned Starr for, heaven forbid, praying and singing hymns during walks along a creek near his home. "He goes down by the Potomac and listens to hymns as the cleansing water of the Potomac goes by," screeched Carville. "And we're going to wash all the sodomites and fornicators out of town." Sidney Blumenthal snarled that Starr fancied himself, quote, "a zealot on a mission from a higher authority," unquote. Words like bimbo and trailer park trash were tossed around brutally by Clintonistas to besmirch women. Bill's victims might have started the hashtag MeToo movement if only a single pro-choice feminist in Washington had been willing to stand at their side. And now, 20 years later, where are we? Well, liberals are practically kicking down the door of the Playboy mansion looking under couches for dirt on Donald Trump. Suddenly, presidential morality matters. It seems only a matter of time before CNN sets up a full-time bureau in a Washington strip club. Poor Anderson Cooper seems to have been dispatched to the porn beat. Now, every new sexual allegation against Donald Trump is an instant headline. No hesitation. Straight to the front pages, baby. Is this hypocrisy by liberals? Oh, yes, you bet it is. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor. Check out my latest book, A Pope and a President, on John Paul II and Ronald Reagan.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country. They include WOLDLP in Woodbridge, New Jersey, WHTYAM in West Palm Beach, Florida, and WYLFAM in Penyon, New York. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on our program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.